Good morning, Justices.
Good morning.
I'm going to give a brief factual history and then a little bit of a procedural history as to this case. On August 28, 2009, a gentleman named Jerry Deere placed a phone call to his son, Tigran Deere, a 7-year-old, and actually at the time he was a 6-year-old child. That phone call ended up being recorded by the soon-to-be ex-wife of Jerry Deere and the mother of Tigran Deere, Suzette Deere, which I will go into more detail in a few minutes regarding how that recording or that phone call and she listening to it came into place. Now, this case was actually not even filed with the DA's office and with an information until December of 2009. The original information was dismissed in July of 2010. A new one filed July 8th of 2010. Now, where the procedure gets a little bit interesting to me is that the trial of the original trial setting and everything, there were multiple ones. There were actually 5 different trial settings. But the actual trial took place September 13, 2010. And now here's where I think something is kind of interesting in the court's record. The defense attorneys, the trial court defense attorney, filed a motion for discovery on September 15, 2010, which is after the trial began. And I think that comes into play later on in some of my arguments. There's 2 main points of error that I found going through the record. And I think that there probably could have been more, but for the second point. And the first point is that the trial court judge abused his discretion by allowing Tigran, a minor child, who at the time of trial was 7 years old, to testify. Under the Texas Rules of Evidence, I think through the judge's questioning, Tigran was not competent to actually testify. I'm going to kind of set aside that point of error and go into my second point of error, which is that the trial court's defense attorney, the actual lawyer who tried the case for Mr. Deere, was ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, the standard of review, as in our brief, it comes under Strickland. And Strickland has 2 main points. In light of the first one, in light of all circumstances, the identified acts or omissions were outside the wide range of professional competent assistance. If that's found, you move to the second point. There is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. Now, the state in their brief tries to kind of simplify this matter because they say there's not enough in the record. There's not enough in the court's record, in the clerk's record, there's not enough in the actual trial testimony. However, if you look at Ex parte Naylor, which is also in the brief, you have to look at the totality of representation. Now, why even raise this on direct appeal? You can do it in several different ways. On this case, it was raised on direct appeal, mainly due to the fact that the trial transcript was not ready at the time of the motion for new trial. And so as appellate counsel, you don't have as much information. And I think that's important because if you look at even the cases that the state has cited, the state wants to say that a silent record means that you cannot review ineffective assistance of counsel. And that's actually not what the cases that the state cited says. In Lauderdale specifically, it says generally, but not always. So generally you can't. Now, if you look at the dissent in Goodspeed, which is also one of the state's cases, Holcomb and Myers joined in the dissent, and they talk about why it could be important to go ahead and raise this on a direct appeal instead of having a motion for new trial or raise it on a writ of habeas corpus. And again, it can be because there is not enough information and you don't have enough time period in order to try to raise it on a motion for new trial or habeas corpus. Now, interestingly enough, Justice Walker wrote an opinion in Aldrich, and in that opinion, there was not a motion for new trial or a writ of habeas corpus. However, this Second Court of Appeals found that because counsel's performance in Aldrich fell below an objective standard of reasonableness as a matter of law, regardless of whether the record adequately reflects trial counsel's subjective reasons for acting as he did, he can be found ineffective. And in Aldrich, as in Ex parte Naylor, the courts, in Ex parte Naylor's at the Houston fourth district. Both courts looked at the totality of the record, what was said in the testimony, what was done. And I think in this case, it is very clear that over and over again, trial counsel just failed to either adequately prepare, adequately file motions, adequately question the defendants, adequately object. And the very first thing that trial counsel failed to do was at the beginning of the trial. Okay, she failed to do any motions to motion in limine, failed to do a motion to suppress. And as I was going over the procedure a minute ago, I think it's very apparent she failed to even file a motion for discovery, which are basic pretrial motions that a defense counsel who is effective would be filing and looking at so that they know what's going to happen in the trial. Why would you file a motion for discovery 2 days after the trial has begun? That is completely ineffective. Now, going into the actual trial, trial counsel, pardon me?
How would it have changed anything? You said you just no open file, there was something your defense counsel didn't know about, and so filing the discovery motion?
With a discovery motion, I personally don't know how that may or may not have affected it, except for the fact that obviously by her filing it, she thought there was something that was not known. It's my understanding that there were several other people that potentially would have been testifying. They did not testify according to the trial record that I've seen, but that could have affected other things, as well as if there were potential trial witnesses for the defense. Well, I think the motion for discovery, like I said, I think it just is another point where the trial counsel failed to do standard pretrial procedures that an effective trial counsel should be taking. I think the more important ones that she failed to file completely was a motion in limine, which could have addressed Exhibit 1/1A, is how that exhibit came in of the state's, which was the actual recording of the conversation between Jerry Deere and Tigran Deere, as well as a pardon me?
Was there an objection to it?
No. There was no objection, and that is one of my major points, is that she failed to object in the trial when Tigran Deere was testifying. It completely let the exhibit come in without any objection, and it came in under Tigran Deere, who is a minor child, and she failed to object to the minor child testifying, that he was competent, despite... I think he would have probably understand more about the trial procedures and his answers. It's very interesting, I think, in the questions that the judge asked, and I can kind of go into that. The judge did ask him some preliminary questions about, you know, do you understand what color your your shirt is, and I'm going to get to that. He said, where do you go to school? Tigran answered, I forgot it. Where? In Arlington, the court asked. I forgot. He then asked, so do you know why you're here today? And the witness asked, why? Do you know why you're here today? No. Then the court asked, if I said your shirt was yellow, would that be the truth? Yes. The court asked, where is the yellow? No. And then the court said, that's right, it wouldn't be the truth. So clearly the child, is not understanding what's going on and is not even able to answer some basic questions about what color the shirt is, what color the shirt isn't. And in Dufresne versus State, which is also a Houston case, that really sets out the standard for what is a competent child and how the child should be asked about what he knows as far as the truth, what is a story. And they go into very, very specific questions over and over. What color is right here on your dress? Well, the child testified about that he was talking to his father, Jerry Deere, okay, and that his mother came in and started recording the conversation. The mother was not a party to the conversation, and that is where Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 1A came in, was through Tigran Deere's testimony.
Okay, he testified he talked to his father. Mm-hmm. The tape recording.
The tape recording is the basis of pretty much the harassment claim.
The tape recording. recording backed up his testimony.
He actually did not testify about, he didn't really testify about what was said completely in the tape recording because he was confused in a lot of his testimony. He kept saying, I don't know, and then the prosecutor would ask how you felt, and he would be like, I was sad. He never completely logically told what was on the tape prior to the tape coming in, or what even after the tape was played, there wasn't any really testimony about what was on the tape and how he understood what was on the tape. Well, when the tape was played, you can hear exactly what happened or what was said between Jerry Deere and Tigran Deere. Yes. Well, that is actually one of my other points, is that I believe that the tape would have been inadmissible because it violated Penal Code 16.02, and that under the Code of Criminal Procedure, if you have an inadmissible recording, it is not allowed to be used as evidence. And the reason that this one would have been inadmissible, first off, you're supposed to either be a party to the tape recording, you should be, or a phone operator, or under the care of the law. So somehow some officer of the law. Suzette Deere is the one who actually recorded the tape. And Suzette Deere was told very specifically in another court order, a family court order, that neither she nor Jerry Deere were supposed to be recording the conversations of the child, their conversations with their child. Obviously, and I don't know for the details because it didn't go into this in the record, but there had to have been some problem, and they kind of talk about that in the record, that a family court would even address that. But they were clearly told, do not record each other's conversations. However, Suzette Deere did record this conversation. Again, she wasn't a party to it. Now, under Alameda, there is a review as to whether or not a parent has vicarious consent for a recording. In Alameda and the underlying case in there, Palometto, it's not a child and a mother and another parent that are involved. In each of those, it's a non-parent that was involved in those recordings. So I think that kind of differentiates this case, because in this case, we had a court order that said, do not record your conversations. We also have a case where it is the two biological parents that were, one of them was recording the other biological parent. Now, in Alameda, it talks about whether or not, if a parent has good faith, whether they can record that child's conversation. And in the testimony by Suzette Deere, she kept saying a red flag. She never specifically said anything else. Well, if a court has already ordered her not to do recording, she's probably going to think anything is a red flag because this has been a problem before.
The child was aware of the tape recording,
When Suzette Deere, his mother, first came in, she put it on speakerphone. And I don't think the child, from gathering the testimony, I'm not sure when he became aware of the recording, but at some point he was aware that it was recorded. I'm not sure if it was during the telephone call, after the telephone call, or after the police got involved. That is unclear in the record. And so therefore, I think, and I believe from all the case law, that Suzette Deere had no right to record this testimony, and therefore the tape would have been inadmissible. With the tape being inadmissible and the trial counsel never filing any type of a motion in limine, motion to suppress, objection at trial under either Tigran's testimony or Suzette's, or even later on when they re-enter the tape and change it from Exhibit 1 to Exhibit 1A, which was a redacted version, there's no objection. And that right there is ineffective assistance of counsel because it was such a crucial piece of evidence. In fact, the jury asked for to hear the tape again. And usually when a jury asks to hear a tape again, they find some type of, something important that they want to listen to. And that was the whole crux of the state's case. There would have been no evidence of harassment on a tape, no evidence of a telephone call, other than if Suzette or if Tigran testified. And then if Tigran never testified, none of the rest would have really gotten in. So I think by not objecting first to Tigran testifying and then not objecting to the exhibit coming in, those two things were crucial in how this trial ended up.
Didn't the mother testify?
The mother did testify second. Most, and I will say most of the testimony of the mother, I don't think it was as damaging as Tigran's in the tape itself, but it had already been played, so.
All right, thank you, Ms. Keenan. Mr. Porter.
May it please the court, Madam Clerk. This case is relatively simple. The appellant has raised two issues. The first, whether or not the trial court abused discretion by admitting the testimony of Tigran Don because he was allegedly incompetent to testify. The appellant concedes in his second point of error in his brief and here to oral argument that issue was not preserved for appellate review by raising a timely objection at trial. So the remaining issue before the court is whether or not Mr. Deere's trial counsel provided ineffective assistance. In this situation, we have a silent record. The appellant has characterized the state's position as that any time you have a silent record that precludes review by an appellate court, that's not the case. That is not the state's position. As Aldrich exemplifies and was cited by the appellant in his brief, Aldrich was one of those egregious cases where trial counsel completely misunderstood Kyles versus Whitley, United States Supreme Court opinion issued, I believe, in the spring of 1995. And having to do with the disclosure of Brady and investigation of Brady material. And it was clear from that silent record, even though there was no hearing where counsel testified at a motion for new trial, that it was so replete throughout the appellate record that counsel had a fundamental misunderstanding of the law and that it prejudiced the appellant in Aldrich that reversal was required in that case. But this is not Aldrich. In this case, we have six different claims of ineffective assistance. I'm not going to bore the court with speculating as to reasonable explanations for the alleged deficiencies. Suffice it to say that reasonable explanations can be made. Trial counsel have not been given opportunity to explain the allegations of alleged ineffective assistance. And the appellant, if he truly believes that he was provided ineffective assistance, has a remedy. He can file a writ of habeas corpus, a misdemeanor application for a writ of habeas corpus that would be determined by Judge Carr and proceed from there. But this is a silent record. I think the court can look at Judge Carr's colloquy with Tigran, and it is a little bit confusing. But the appellate case law that has dealt with this issue says that it's okay for 7-year-old boys and 6-year-old girls to seem a little confused. Imagine you're a 6-year-old boy or girl and you're testifying in this court. You're surrounded by strange people you don't know. They're all adults. You're going to be a little intimidated. And anytime you have confusing or inconsistent responses from a child, those are not reasons to determine that the child is incompetent to testify. Rather, they speak to the witness's credibility, and that's the determination from the San Antonio Court of Appeals in N. Ray A.W. cited in the state's brief, but it's 147 Southwest 3rd, 632. That's not in the record, but Justice Dauphineau, I think that's a fair conclusion from the record. I think if you read Tigran's testimony, it's very clear. He loves both his parents. And that is speculation on my part, but I think that would be fair to say based on the record in this case. I feel sorry for him. I really do. But that's not to say one way or the other as far as the appellant's claims. I don't think my sympathy or the court's sympathy should affect the court's adjudication of the appellant's claims. But in this case, we have a silent record, and I think there are reasonable explanations. The court has discussed the open file policy, and there's nothing in the appellate record to indicate that somehow filing a motion for discovery would reveal information that was not otherwise available in the open file, through the open file policy and through the electronic case filing system. I think the trial court did not abuse its discretion by determining Tegren was competent to testify based on the record, and given his responses later on to both the prosecutor's questions and defense counsel's questions, it showed he was able to respond rationally and coherently to those questions through the eyes of a 7-year-old boy. The failure to object to leading questions, there may have been a reasonable explanation for that. Trial counsel may have decided we didn't want to antagonize the jury by objecting repetitively. We didn't want to put them off. Instead, we wanted to take a trial tactic where maybe we engender sympathy for Jerry in this case. There are a bunch of different reasons. The failure to move for a directed verdict, which is another basis for ineffective assistance claim, that's a motion, basically a challenge to legal sufficiency. If the appellant believed that the evidence was legally insufficient to support his conviction, he didn't raise that issue on appeal. And then the failure to understand the law applicable to the case, that again goes back to whether or not Exhibit 1A and 1 were admissible. In the cases cited by the state in the brief on direct appeal, if you look at Alameda, it discusses whether a parent can vicariously consent to a minor child's, for a minor child, in tape recording a conversation. Now, the appellant has made the point that there was a civil court order out there prohibiting the parent from tape recording each other's conversations. True. And that order would be enforceable by civil contempt in the trial court. But it doesn't affect the legal admissibility of the evidence because it wasn't a violation of the penal code for Suzette to consent on her son's behalf to tape record a conversation that she believed, reasonably believed, might be harmful to Tegren. And that's the law. Pardon? Unfortunately, Your Honor, that is the case in many acrimonious divorce situations. And that's, I think, why we're here today. And for that, I apologize, Your Honors. But that's something beyond my control. Based on the silent record and based on the failure to preserve the first issue, the state would ask the court to affirm the trial court's judgment in all things. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Porter. Ms. Keenan, rebuttal. Well, I want to first address one of the things that the state said, which was regarding the testimony of Tegren. If you look in the actual record and what he's saying, and this is kind of going to a question that you had asked earlier, when the first type of questions that he was asked, when your daddy called you, did he ever talk to you or say anything to you about your mom? And he answers yes. What kind of things would he say to you about your mom? I don't know. And that's on page 22 of the record. Okay, does he say anything to you about your mom that you don't like? No. There's another one kind of further down. It says, what kinds of things has he said on the telephone that makes you scared? I forgot. And this is very typical of his whole testimony throughout after the initial questioning by Judge Carr. So when you're looking at whether or not a child is competent or not competent to testify, you're going to look at first the questions that were asked kind of as the predicate from the court, but also at the testimony himself later on to see if he could even give intelligent answers. And throughout his testimony it was, I don't know, no, he was confused. And I think that shows right there that he could not form intelligent answers. Whether or not, you know, he was doing it because he didn't want to say something against his father, I don't think that was necessarily as much as he's a 7-year-old child and didn't completely understand the process, nor all of the questions that were asked him. Whether or not that was from the state not preparing him properly, or whether it was from the defense not trying to talk to him beforehand, I don't know the answer to it, but clearly through his testimony he didn't.
What was going on? It's not obvious to me.
Well, even if he was protecting his father, the trial counsel still should have objected to that testimony and should have gone into more voir dire and tried to bring it out, I think, further. And I think it could have changed the outcome of the trial. Now, kind of moving away from the testimony of Tigran and into what the state was saying about a silent record. Again, I want to go back to you're looking at the totality of the trial and of the totality of all of the ineffective assistance of counsel. So it may not be one thing like the directed verdict that the state was talking about that will not make it over the Strickland standard. But when you start putting everything together, I think you start seeing a bigger picture that the trial counsel simply was unable or had not prepared adequately for this trial and was not objecting. She did not do any pretrial motions. She did not investigate. I mean, an investigation, going back to, I know we were talking about the motion for discovery, a basic investigation, filing a motion for discovery is basic investigation, and she failed to do that until 2 days after trial. Whether or not it would have changed the outcome, we may not know from that one point, but if you're looking at everything, there's six major things that she failed to do that I pointed out in the brief. There probably are even more, when going back and looking at the record, I can find other places to object. From looking at the questions asked, who was presented for witnesses, and that the court had, the actual jury asked for the protective order, and she never even presented this order that was talked about so much that they weren't supposed to be having these recordings. And I think that shows clearly that there was not an investigation done, or at least not one where she had decided what she was going to do. Now, we talked a little bit about the acrimonious divorce, and that I think that is apparent from the record. I don't necessarily think it is something that goes into whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in allowing Tigran to testify, or whether or not the trial counsel was ineffective. And so I think that needs to be completely set aside and not necessarily looked at, even though it is a sad situation as you read the record. But when you look at it in a legal perspective and not and kind of apart and aside from any feelings, legally, the trial counsel was ineffective. Legally, Tigran should not have been allowed to testify. And that one thing right there should have been objected to, as well as many other things throughout the record. Thank you. And for those reasons, we'd like to have it reversed and remanded.
Thank you, Ms. Keenan. Thank you, Mr. Porter. We appreciate all of your arguments today and your briefing. Your case is submitted. You all are excused, and we'll take a 20-minute recess and pick up the 10:30 docket.